Hello, and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences, to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 229. I'm Vince Diamante, recording from not-so-sunny Southern California. I've got a friend over here who's also in Southern California, although about 2 hours away from me. Mike, how's it going in your neck of the woods?
It's going well. And, you know, in the greater Los Angeles area, 2 hours away could just mean a mile. So it really depends on traffic. But yeah, things are doing splendidly over here.
Yeah, I agree. It's way better than it was about 2 weeks ago, where it seemed like the whole state was on fire.
That was crazy. I know you listeners never tire of hearing our Southern California weather updates, but I have to say that it was extraordinarily hot and humid, which is something we are not used to out here. We are not adapted for humidity anymore. So it was very harsh.
Indeed. That's not what I signed up for. I would actually much prefer to sign up for something really cool. Maybe I should go to a further northern climb, perhaps somewhere in Scandinavia. Alex, what do you think about that?
I see you have your segue game in fine form today there, Vince. You're segueing like a professional. Guess what? I happen to live in Sweden. What a coincidence.
Wow. Tell us about that.
Well, it is not excruciatingly hot here at the moment. Actually, it's very nice. Quite a lot of rain. But it's been a hot minute since our last show, and I have literally been around the world. I think all of us have, if we combine together our respective plane routes over the past month or 2 months that we've been on a little bit of a summer break, I think we could probably make it to the moon, I suppose. Wait a moment. How far away is the moon? That was a rather ridiculous thing to say, wasn't it? Anyway, I've been to Australia and now I'm back in Sweden. And it was winter in Australia, so there we go. That's the that's my comment on the weather.
That's cool. That's very cool. I just looked it up. The moon is only about 24,000 some miles away. So it's maybe a bit of a stretch, but not that far of a stretch.
What's the circumference of the Earth in miles?
Oh, the circumference.
Just thinking of how many times around the world you'd have to go in order to get the equivalent frequent flyer miles for a trip to the moon.
Oh, wait a minute. I read that wrong. The circumference is 24,000 some miles. Okay. The moon is 240,000 miles.
All right. So two trips around the Earth.
So I was off by an order of magnitude there.
but basically 1.8, 1.9 times around the globe, and you could have gone to the moon, is what you're saying.
I guess so.
let's just leave it at that, shall we? Because I'm getting more and more embarrassed by my stupid comment there. Anyway, how about that game audio?
Welcome to the Astronomy Hour.
Yes, that's right.
Game audio is pretty cool.
A great field. I think we all like it.
I'm a big fan, honestly. I've been having some fun playing around with some new toys, some new recording stuff, some new equipment, especially new microphones. Are you guys familiar with Dodotronic?
I'm not, but that is a fantastic name. Dodotronic. Is their logo like literally a dodo bird? It better be.
No, actually, I don't think it is.
Oh, that's a disappointment. That's an opportunity missed right there.
Yeah, a bit. But they don't need to have a fancy logo or branding when their stuff just does such cool stuff and it's not that expensive. So, long story short, I decided to get back into my Ultra mics. So a few years back, I got one of their early USB Ultra mics. And they're called Ultra mics because they're all about recording ultrasonic frequencies, stuff that's above 20 kilohertz, and actually much, much more above 20 kilohertz. And it does it at a relatively cheap price, because there are some very fancy high-frequency microphones out there. If you go the Sanken route or Earthworks or Sony, you can get these microphones that are very good at recording super high frequencies for around $1,000 at a minimum. But Dodotronic, they actually make these ultrasonic microphones that plug in via USB, and you can record at 192 kilohertz or 250 kilohertz, and they only cost a few $100. Wow. In this case, I decided, oh man, you know, I actually like this this older Ultra mic that I got. And I decided, what if I just got the new one, or the most expensive one, which isn't that expensive. So the 250 kilohertz version of their Ultra mic is about 250 euros. And since I've been able to carve a bit more time for doing some more creative recording out there, I've been having some fun with this thing. There is the limitation that it has to plug in via USB, so I have my laptop around as opposed to something more compact, like a field recorder. But it's really damn fun just recording all sorts of random things, whether it be my dogs around the house or, you know, moving things like doors and pots and pans and, you know, just tapping the walls in different places and seeing what it sounds like. So, yeah, this is one of the many new toys that I have gotten recently.
Okay, so I've got to ask. So this is the first time I've ever heard of ultrasonic audio recording. So this is amazing. Can you explain, what is it for? What does it sound like? What are the benefits? Tell me more.
So it's just, for me, it's a lot about the potential for sound malleability and just doing lots of processing on it, because you have that much more material to work with. So one of the more common things that I've done in the past, I know some other sound designers have done it, but hey, let's record some creatures and pitch down and pitch down, right, and pitch down and turn it into one of those very common things in video games, which is the big, awesome, terrifying creature that will rip your face off.
Right. But
if you're only recording at, say, CD quality audio, there's just no material above that original 20 kilohertz limit. So you're pitching that stuff down, and it sounds cool, but you don't have any other further overtones above that. But if you record all that high-frequency material, you know, not just above 20 kilohertz, but reaching all the way up to 100 or 120 kilohertz, thanks to a really high sampling rate, then you are able to capture more of those overtones, and it will actually sound much more natural, as opposed to being totally empty up there when you pitch material down drastically.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, you mentioned sampling rate, and I'm curious what sampling rates you have to use when making these recordings.
So that's the thing about these microphones. It's not just a microphone, but it's also an analog to digital converter in the chassis. So you really only have one option there. So for the 250K microphone, you record at 250 kilohertz. You have no option to record at the lower sampling rates. And if you want to do that, you have to either have another one of those ultra mics there. They sell them in these different permutations: ultra mic 192, ultra mic 200K. So that's a little bit annoying compared to having a regular microphone and you plug it into your interface and you just change the sampling rate of your interface and to record whatever you want. So that's an interesting limitation there. And because it is its own microphone with its own analog to digital interface, that kind of gets in the way of whatever audio hardware you've got there. There's no way to clock all of your hardware together. Like, I've got a nice audio card. I cannot have my other audio card running and recording other stuff in lockstep with this microphone. When I plug this microphone into my computer, that's effectively it. This is my only audio device, and I got to deal with it, which is okay, because when I'm bringing my laptop and this microphone out, then that's all I'm doing. I'm just playing around with recording stuff and seeing what comes out on the other end.
I'm straining my imagination, and I'm trying to think of other applications for ultrasonic recording other than taking your recording and pitch shifting it down so that it falls within the audible spectrum and then hearing all these cool previously hidden partials in the stratosphere brought down to our level. But beyond that, what are some other applications of this kind of recording?
Man, I mean, there are a lot of things regarding field recording for animals. So most of the stuff that I've seen out there are recording creatures. You see things on YouTube about someone that's trying to capture bat sounds and, you know, stuff like that. For me, like, honestly, it just happens to be at that nice price where it is it's a toy that I can play with and see if it gives me some new material that I wasn't previously privy to. So that's kind of where it is right now. But when you say that, yeah, I'm not totally sure. It's not really the most robust thing out there. You don't want to use it for everything. The fact that you can't really interface this with your existing hardware is kind of annoying. There are other limitations to this thing as well. This is actually a pretty noisy microphone. Modern microphones these days, your cheap stuff is really very good and very low noise. That didn't used to be the case in the 80s and 90s, where if you were spending $100, $200 on a microphone, it was noisy as heck. But now everything is great these days. These microphones, they're extremely noisy. But if you're doing a good job of, you know, pointing it or getting it close to something that is making a strong sound, and you're going to capture that really strongly relative to the environment that it's in, you're not really worried too much about that. But still, this isn't the most versatile instrument out there. But at that price, which is, you know, 200, 250, you know, 300 euros for the most expensive one of these things, I think it's really cool.
So the impulse buy threshold price is 10 times the impulse buy threshold price for a software plugin.
I think that's about right. Yeah.
That's the math.
Also, the fact that the euro is pretty good for us over in the US these days, that definitely helped.
Now that you mentioned the pitch shifting applications, I'd be really interested in hearing the hidden ultrasonic partials of a musical instrument, doing the same thing for a musical instrument instead of a, you know, an animal, just to hear, like, you know, what are the parts of the flute that pass beyond human perception? That would seems to me like a really interesting musical scientific study.
Yeah, that sounds really good to me too. I've got a couple of friends that are some really good violinists, and they have their own microphones that they record with, some very, very good reputable microphones, you know, Shure's and Neumann's and Earthworks and things like that. But I don't think they've ever tried recording with one of these there. And I imagine that looking at the really high partials of a violin would be awesome.
Internally, is it a little bit like a ribbon or a condenser microphone in that it cannot take, very high amounts of sudden air pressure like a dynamic microphone could? So would you be able to record like a percussive sound at a fairly loud volume, or do you have to be, you know, very careful with that?
Nah, I think that these are actually pretty durable instruments. So they're basically omnidirectional with a little bit of variance in how directional it is based on where in the frequency spectrum you're actually listening to. But the actual capsule is a very small electret capsule that is really hard to damage in any way. So I wouldn't be worried putting this in front of something extremely loud, whether it be a guitar amp or some loud drums. And similarly, I wouldn't be worried just throwing it around and trashing it if need be. It seems like a very simple device in terms of how it's constructed. So I think that this thing can really take a thrashing.
Wow. Well, next Game Audio Hour, you should see if you can rig it up for recording for the show and see if we can spot a difference with your voice.
Oh, man.
Vince, you sound really bright today. I can't figure out why.
That's right. Very breathy today, Vince. What's going on? What's with all this lip smack and breath?
Yeah. Oh, man. I mean, that sounds cool, except, like I said before, you can't really interface it with other stuff. So this would be your audio interface, and there's no headphone out on it. So when you're recording things, basically blind. And then at the other end, you're going to have to listen to it and see what happens. You know, you'll make the WAV file and then unplug it, and then maybe you'll plug in your headphones at that point and see what comes out.
Force you to commit. That's what, you know, people who always rendering everything down to audio at every opportunity that they can when they're mixing, so they don't, you know, get paralyzed by choices and fine-tuning at the wrong time. That forces you to commit, you know. You commit to your recording. It's like film photography, right?
You know, absolutely.
You don't know what you've got until you press stop and you go and have a listen.
Well, there's definitely something to be said for this kind of experimental, exploratory approach. And particularly when you have the time and you're not under a raging deadline where you have to fall back on the tried and true and familiar. But I actually have a little anecdote I can offer that I feel like is of a similar spirit to what you've described.
Cool. What have you been doing?
Well, I've been doing some palette assembling, musical instrument palette assembling for a scoring project. And the score happens to be a film score, but I think this could apply equally to game scores or really anything. I've been trying to find a category of instrument that I often like to work with, something that feels organic, but is not immediately mappable to any particular acoustic instrument. Something processed, but maybe not too, cover your ears, Alex, not too synthy. You can listen again, Alex. So I was kind of flipping through my various sample libraries, and like every composer today, I've got far more sounds than I could ever catalog, let alone use. And I was going preset after preset after preset, different synths, different sample libraries, just making a log of things that seemed like they had some potential, with the mandate that I then go back later and then listen through all the ones that I flagged. And pretty quickly, I mean, I did get some useful sounds out of this process, but it was so fatiguing. And after a while, you know, when you're auditioning sounds that are deliberately a little weird or off, there's an extra degree of fatigue, and it starts to eventually feel just like a river of sonic data. And that sensitive artistic part of your mind starts to numb out. And I thought there's got to be a better way of doing something like this. So this morning, actually, I had this stray thought, which is, what if I took like a Wurlitzer electric piano, drastically changed its envelope quality so that it had a very sloped attack, like you're using a pedal on a guitar for pedal swells, and then gave it this massive kind of everlasting ambience. Now, the three things I lacked were a Wurlitzer electric piano, a guitar swell pedal, and sufficient patience to get either. So I decided, well, let's try the digital version of this. And I found a pretty good electric piano plugin. I think it was Sonokinetic or one of the other regulars. One that sounded realistic enough that I didn't care about the difference. And I just started playing with doing things to it, like tweaking the contact parameter of the attack to give it that slope effect. So it wasn't like I was hitting, you know, it sounded like an E-bow on a guitar, basically, this gentle, gradual swelling in. And then I just piped it through one of Valhalla's more spacious and dirty-sounding reverb, dirty in the sense of having lots of artifacts on the tail, you know, very modulated tail, and just playing around with it that way. And I really liked the effect, and it was nothing sophisticated, right? This is nothing, you know, people could do this without having any exotic equipment. But it was so much more fun, and what I came up with might not have been drastically different than what's in my sample library, but there was a kind of authorship and experimentation that was a lot of fun and that made me really feel connected to this instrument. And to be clear, I was, you know, you're just, the way I had it set it up, you're just listening to the reverb. There was no direct sound at all. So it kind of had that spacious ambient quality, but because it was coming from at least a sample of a electroacoustic instrument, it felt a little more grounded in physical reality than synth patch number 26,005. And I'm not even necessarily bragging about the sound, but the process was just so much more gratifying than going through endless presets, which I'd done the other day, And I felt very engaged and part of a creative process. And I started thinking, oh, I could use this sound for this cue, and this would be great for this cue. And I can, and it was just such a better way of coming up with interesting effects than the endless cycling through, you know, countless presets. So to try to tie this back, Vince, to what you were talking about, there's just a kind of delight you can obtain in direct experimentation and plugging things into other things, whether they be hardware or software, or as is common, some combination of the two, that I think just engages us as artists and prevents that horrible fatigue from setting in. So I think in the future, I'm going to try to create or really modify more sounds through this kind of mad scientist experimentation and less through looking for pre-packaged solutions from increasingly eccentric sample libraries. End of anecdote.
That sounds great. Actually, a little timely because I'm working on a project with a singer at the moment. She has a specific request that she wants synthetic sounds that don't sound synthy. When you think of synthesizer sounds, you know, the first thing that comes to mind are subtractor synthesizers. You know, we all know what they sound like. So trying to get as far away from that as possible has also led me to try to experiment with other ways of producing synthetic sounds that don't sound kind of stereotypically synthesizer-ish. And actually, similar to the process that you describe with Kontakt, two synths that I've been using, actually three. Number one, ironically, is a DX7 clone from Plog called ChipSynth OPS7, extremely faithful recreation of the Yamaha DX7. And FM synthesis, you know, when it's handled very, very carefully, can also move you away from what people typically associate with the sound of a synthesizer. That also physical modeling synths, of which there really aren't enough. I think we've mentioned it before on the show before, haven't we? That physical modeling is such a cool part of artificial sound creation, and that doesn't. Seems this just not quite enough, you know. We've got Native Instruments Prism, and you've got Chromaphone, and you've got Madrona Labs, and I can't really think of any of the other ones at the moment. That's how
there's Pianotech.
It seems like there's a little bit of retro future there, because so many of the really big striking experiments were started in the 90s, and then they just sort of petered out, and then every now and then you see these other things happen.
Yeah, I think was the Yamaha VLM-1, wasn't it? Which is we talked about that before. Because physical modeling is, obviously it's really great for things like Pianotech if you actually want to model something that sounds realistic. But I remember being completely blown away by a demo on the CD that came with a Future Music magazine edition, of which I was religiously subscribed back in the day. And on the CD, it had a demo of the Yamaha VLM-1 when it came out. And obviously, you've got your flutes and cellos and plucked guitar sounds and all of the standard things that you would expect for a physical modeling synthesizer. But there was also on that CD a patch of a synthesizer, like a synth lead sound that was created using the Yamaha VLM-1. So it was this incredible texture that didn't sound like a subtractor synthesizer or like FM synthesis, just something totally different. And I've been sort of trying to recreate something like that ever since. And the only synth that I've found that does physical modeling that kind of comes close to that is Prism by Native Instruments. The other ones, not really. But there's two synthesizers that I've been working with actually for some really creative sample mangling that you might want to look into, Mike. One of them is Pigments by Arturia, and the other one is Phase Plant by Kilohertz. And both of these are sort of flagship, do-it-all workhorse. They can all achieve different kinds of synthesis paradigms like subtractive, additive, sample-based, granular, etc., etc. But the things that you can do with samples, specifically in these two, Pigments and Phase Plant, it's quite interesting. So obviously you take the standard things that are available to you in a sampler. It can do all of that. For example, as you mentioned, you know, you drop in a sample and then you give it an envelope with a really long attack time or something like that. But that combined with all of the other features that it provides as a synthesizer, like unison modes, granular start points, and all kinds of, and you know, interesting ways to loop the sample, things like that, you can get some really amazing, interesting textures that way, which sound obviously synthetic, but not cliched in the sort of stereotypical synth fashion.
That does sound really cool.
Yeah, I've been seeing so much of that stuff lately. I think because I have a little bit more time these days, I've been going down the Twitter rabbit hole, and I recently have been seeing all these awesome examples of sound design in Pigments, and especially Phaseplant, just some really virtuosic sound design and sometimes also instrument design in Phaseplant that I think, I need to get into this now. Why am I not playing with this right now, please?
Yeah, Phaseplant is really good. It reminds me a little bit of Yuhi Zebra. It's sort of like a semi-modular kind of approach where you can add sound sources on one side, and you can add modulation blocks of any kind on the other side, and you can kind of connect them all together. One thing that Phaseplant does really, really well is its effects processing. So basically you have three lanes of, again, sort of like a semi-modular situation where you can drop in internal effects into these three lanes, or multiple effects into single lanes. And then you can actually route internally any one of your sound sources that are being generated through any one of these effects lanes. So yeah, it really opens the synth up to a whole range of different kinds of textures and sounds just based on the merits of this effect routing structure that it has. It's pretty great.
Actually, if I could also add another idea to the pot here. Alex, you were mentioning AES's stuff with chromophone and that type of modeling. I was just reminded that they have something called Object Delay, and it's ostensibly a delay-type plugin, but this might also work pretty well for the sounds that you're looking for, Mike, because really, it doesn't have to be a delay plugin. At the heart of it is, let's take the resonator simulation part of chromophone and allow you to feed it with whatever sound that you have on your track. So that might be a cool way of looking at it. It's called Object Delay, OBJEQ. Yeah, it's not just a delay plugin. And also, it's sometimes available on sale, as is the want of plugins these days, down from the usual $140 to something well under $50. So
just lastly, I have one more recommendation for you, Mike. There's a really good synth from Yuhi. A really good synth from Yuhi. What a surprise. Sorry. there's a synth from Yuhi, which is really good, like pretty much everything that they do, which is called Triple Cheese. And it's one of their free synths that's been around for a long time. And it does comb filtering as its main kind of synthesis paradigm. And that is fantastic for doing things that sound like bowed sounds, as well as plucks. Definitely worth checking out. It's a bit esoteric because it's not your typical... You'll look at it and the controls might be a little bit confusing. There won't be controls that you will be used to seeing from a synthesizer, but the sound textures you can get out of it are obviously synthetic, but also very, very different from your stereotypical synth sounds. So yeah, that's a free download as well, so that's worth checking out.
Well, you mentioned my favorite magic words, so I'm all over that as soon as this show is done. You know, you could argue that game composers are better equipped to take advantage of these opportunities to experiment than film and TV composers because of the typical deadline structure for a game project compared to traditional linear media. Because only in game music do we really have time to have an experimental phase and one that could linger and continue throughout the project. Whereas in film and TV, you're typically just gunning for that deadline and you have to, as I said earlier, just fall back on the tried and true. But if you're in a, you know, a comparatively leisurely, you know, 6 month or year long or 18 month delivery schedule, you know, between those milestone delivery targets, you have a little downtime where you can go and tweak your tools and reinvestigate what you've been using and even play around with these cool resources.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's the norm in for game production schedules. It's more likely 2 weeks before Goldmaster and, oh no, we need music, quick. Quick, somebody get some music in.
I was about to say that because, yeah, I was smiling the whole time. I feel like, at least with some of the projects that I've been on, because they are live projects, that it actually feels like a TV series might be a close comparison in terms of how the production schedule actually works out. We need to deliver this to Apple, to Switch. We need to get it up and running so that we're QA testing it across a bunch of devices. So there is a really strong schedule, and people expect seasonal content to hit at these points, and you don't really deviate that. You don't really deviate from that unless it's just absolutely impossible. I mean, you know, maybe on your big AAA games where you've got 3 years and 4 years, but I've only been, I've been lucky enough to be on those types of games at least a few times in my career, but that's definitely not the norm for me.
Yeah, I think that it's getting better these days. You know, it used to be, I mean, I haven't been in the doing game audio for as long as you both have, but I remember that about, what was it, like 10 or 11 years ago when I started, it was, you know, everybody kind of understood that sound and music in games is important, but conveniently tended to forget that very often during the actual production, especially on sort of medium-sized or small indie projects. It's like, you know, yeah, oh, I'm really passionate about game audio. I love it. Oh, it's really important. Game music, fantastic. Sound effects, really important. And then, you know, it always ends up that like 2 or 3 weeks before beta, it's like everybody's scrambling. Oh, we need audio. Quick, get somebody to come and do audio. It's like we definitely, or at least we used to, what I remember, we always used to have absolute rock bottom lowest priority on the grand scheme of all the things that you need to make a video game. And yet, when you ask people, you know, they'll always be quick to say, yeah, oh, game music, sound effects, really important. Yeah, absolutely fundamental. And yet, we're always rock bottom on that priority scale in terms of scheduling. And so it was always a case of... And I'm sure many of our listeners listening to this as well will be able to recall contracts and projects they've done where it's just been panic stations because, you know, the audio has been left to the very, very last moment. But I feel it's getting better these days. I think that, you know, there's much more recognition and much more understanding outside of the game audio sphere for programmers and project managers and producers and people who are doing the scheduling. There's much more understanding about, you know, basically if you give your game audio engineer or your composer more time, you get a better result.
It's interesting that you throw around the word always, because I've never quite had that panicked a schedule, including, Alex, when I have worked for you. So clearly there are occasions where schedules are more gentle than what you've described, though I'm certain that a number of people also have to race for the deadline in games, depending on the nature of the project and the size of the company.
I think you guys were really lucky there, having an experienced audio person also working as your producer.
I was just going to say, Mike, yes, that there is... probably some degree of advantage of working for me, I suppose, because I understand that the more time that you have, the better result that we get. So, yeah,
there's definitely sympathy built in when a composer is also the audio director of a project that you are composing for. So, I recommend it to all our listeners.
Yeah, I think it is getting better though, Leon. I think the recognition and the acknowledgement just of the importance of music and the role that music plays beyond just, you know, oh, put in some sound effects. Hey, it feels like a video game now. You know, that classic classic comment that you get when you're doing a prototype and you put in some sound effects and people say, oh, it feels like a video game now. And you're thinking to yourself, yeah, funny about that. It's called game audio. It's rather good. It's quite important.
It is really tough to engineer that time, and not just the time, but also that understanding among everyone that it's not just, oh, we have zero sound, to, oh, we have sound, we're ready to ship, that these things can be iterated upon and experimented with, and you do real research and development in order to get to either a target that you know is possible or to an uncertain place where you know that there's a possibility, but there's still a chance. There's a possibility of failure in your pursuit of something fun or cool or excellent. And in order to do that, you iterate, you go through possibilities, you go and work at the sound more than just filling in a cell or checkbox on a spreadsheet that says if the sound is in the game or not.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that, you know, fundamentally people, I mean, we're visual creatures before we are, auditory creatures. And, you know, when it comes to, say, for example, video game art, a consumer or a fellow colleague in a different role on the development side of a video game production process, everybody can kind of quite easily and quickly identify good quality game art from from bad quality game art. You know, it's quite easy to wow somebody with excellent visuals in a video game, and if you've got very, very poorly done graphics, it doesn't take much degree of specialized knowledge or experience to identify that. However, when it comes to music and sound effects, I don't know. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think it's in many cases I think you both know what I'm trying to say, but I can't. It's late on a Friday night and I'm not going to articulate this very well, so you might have to help me. But in my experience, there's been more cases of me seeing that, wow, like people don't really hear the difference between extremely high quality game audio and just passable mediocre game audio. Maybe one of you can help me articulate that a little better.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Especially in the art world and the design world, there are so many things that we are aware of. Here is early prototype art. Here is a gray box level. This thing has no textures on it. This is the model of your character, but obviously the animation is not working as expected. And someone who is a layperson can just have that in their mind and say, okay, yes, I understand. My character is not animating as expected, even though they are actually traversing around this 3D level. Oh, I get it. There is no texture on the walls. It is a gray box. On the other hand, when it comes to audio, it's really difficult for not just people who are laymen, but also for professionals to clearly and quickly recognize that a sound or a piece of music is somewhere in that in-between state of making its way towards being a fully produced and polished piece of aural work, and they're not sure how to react to it. Hey, is this the right sound? I guess it's a sound. Does it do its purpose, its function? I guess, maybe.
Yeah, very often, if you have bad sound or like incomplete or, rushed work for sound in a game, the effect that it has on somebody who's not really tuned into listening for game audio quality, the effect that it has is very it's much more subconscious, isn't it? It's much more subliminal. You know, people would say, it's kind of all right. I guess this game, you know, on the other hand, if you have exceptionally good game audio, then people may not identify the audio as being good, but they will sort of, yeah, this game is, it feels really visceral. It feels really, you know, juicy. You know, they'll use words like that, and they may not actually realize that's because of the extra quality in the sound that they're hearing. So It's almost like, as primarily visual creatures that humans are, the sound has a very powerful role to play, but the person perceiving it all together may not realize that it's actually because of the sound.
I was just thinking about working with an orchestra, actually. When you're dealing with recording a score and you're working with an orchestra of 50, 60, 70 people, it's possible that there are mistakes that are actually being played in that ensemble. And even though everyone there is a professional, including the conductor, the engineers, the composers that are in the room watching and listening and tracking on the score, they might not recognize that a mistake is made. And often when a player does make a mistake, they feel, or they're actually told, that the onus is on them to actually pipe up about it. And they'll just be like, oh, yes, I messed up that run. And they'll do it just by making a very, very obvious mistake on their instrument so that, oh, all right, yeah, we need to start from the top again. Let's do this. Mm. And I was actually thinking about maybe that's a way that we should approach putting sounds in our games when they're not quite ready. You know, hey, we're still in the middle of producing this game. I don't want people to get used to these sounds that I have there, these temp sounds. And maybe I should go in the other direction of, here are obviously functional sounds that are also obviously wrong in order to communicate the fact that this is obvious temp sound. Because that's a thing that comes up where, oh yeah, this is functional sound, and then people, whether it be other developers or an external QA team or even, you know, beta players, they'll get used to these sounds, and then they'll balk if you have an awesome, better produced sound at the other end of the full production process.
So what do you do to make these stand-in placeholder sounds sound crap enough? How do you do that?
What if you did like vocal? You vocalized the sound instead of recording it.
Do.
Exactly, with the caveat that it could backfire and might end up being the stylistic signature of the audio.
I mean, it could be. Yeah,
that's a great idea.
I do think that it is possible to make things that are in such a drastically different style. Like this game that I've been working on, Sky, it has a very natural sound to it. It's you don't really have a lot of obvious synthesizer sounds. You don't hear just a straight up DX7 sound just playing on there, right? But you know, maybe if I used that type of sound in order to indicate, okay, yes, this game mechanic has a sound attached to it. This is a placeholder sound. It is totally not in the style of anything else that's in the game. Boom. And people recognize that. You don't have to necessarily be that person recording into a mic, menu button click every time you go through a menu hierarchy. Perhaps something like that, where you do that very obviously synthy sound versus, the style that's been established previously.
Mike, have you ever found yourself in a situation where somebody's asked you to score something to put in like a temp track, a placeholder thing first? I think you've mentioned many times before that it is a, not so much a risk, but there is a potential that people fall in love with the temp track and you end up just having to go with that. But have you ever found yourself in the situation like Vince mentions, where you've realized that, okay, it's going to be really important for me to make it totally, totally clear here that this is placeholder and it will be redone, so don't get used to it? If you found yourself in that situation before, what have you done to actually, to kind of, watermark your placeholder sound so that people will not get used to it and not fall in love with it.
Well, I think that's never happened to me in game scoring. I think when this touches back on the issue of scheduling, I've always been brought in early enough in the process where there wasn't, you know, by the time it was time for music, then I was there and ready to go. With film, what I've found is that it's the editor who typically selects the temp tracks, and those temp tracks will influence editorial pace and a lot of the emotional content of the scene. And in that case, the real danger is having to imitate the temp track. But I've never been put in a position where I had to provide a temp track. Occasionally, I'll provide role models for a score generally. I'll say, like, here are a couple of cues that potentially give the aesthetic for the overall music of this score. But I don't think I've ever had to temp a scene or a level, you know, the game equivalent.
In at my company at Moon Mode, we call this WIP-itis, or WIP-itis, which is this phenomenon of work in progress, WIP, work in progress content that gets evaluated even though it's work in progress. And yeah, it for the person on the creation side, it can be very frustrating that you know, you've put something in quickly and it's like, Vince, you know, the sound effects here, it kind of sounds like your voice saying menu button click. Maybe we could have it sound like a button instead. And you're just there going like, yes, I know. Thank you for pointing out the obvious. It's a temporary placeholder. I wish you'd recognize that. Or, you know, we've learned that at least internally at Moon Mode, you know, it is quite important to actually just tell people that, like, okay, if this is a placeholder, so please don't read anything into it, because it's just there to fill the position while I go off and spend proper time to make the final sound. If you don't say that, then yeah, you run that risk of getting hit by the whip-itis.
I think you really lost an opportunity by not calling it whiplash.
Whiplash, there we go. Menu button click, menu button click, menu button click. I don't know, Vince, I think... that game company, Sky, could probably benefit from the sound of your voice going like this. I think that'd be great.
I've scored a game that did that for its sound design. It actually hired, I forget the gentleman's last name. His first name is Michael. And
Michael Winslow.
Famous. Yes, Michael Winslow. famous if you're of a certain age for his Foley-like vocal effects in the Police Academy movies. Which I don't actually recommend watching these days, but this game hired him to do all their sound or most of their sound effects as vocal Foley. So it literally was him going pachoop, pachoop, pachoop. But in this case, he was so good at doing it, you couldn't actually tell that it was vocal Foley. And it just sounded like really expressive sound design. Unfortunately, they didn't have him do the music because that would have put me out of a job, but it was really fun to work on.
That sounds great.
He's so good. First of all, yeah, Police Academy, they don't age well, but thankfully YouTube is great. So you could get your 2 minute, 3 minute, just get a little bit of Michael Winslow in those 2 minute, 3 minute jaunts on YouTube, and that will do the trick. Also, doing that mouth Foley is really, really cool. And it's one of those things that I highly recommend to sound designers to do when they're working on sound effects, just because we're so good when it comes to speaking and singing and little bits of inflection and accents and the way that we work the sound with our mouth, that if we have that in place for a sound, it's, and you try to design to the things that you do when you're speaking or singing a sound effect, you can actually do some really cool stuff just by trying to hit all the things that that you're trying to do with the sound of your voice, because it is so expressive. There's so many possibilities, and getting your hardware or software sound design instruments to match that expressive possibility is really a workout.
Yeah, actually, that's something that most people can do quite well. You know, I mentioned just a moment ago that, you know, there's quite a lot of Well, it's not uncommon to come across colleagues on the development side of games who don't have a really, really sophisticated discerning. You know what I'm trying to say again, and I'm having trouble articulating it, but this is really difficult to do without offending people. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, it's not uncommon to find people who basically have no taste when it comes to sound. But one thing is that even those kinds of people, you know, if you just ask them, can you just like make a sound of what you think it should sound like, then you'll usually find that they have some really, really, really cool ideas when they just use their mouth. It seems to be something that all humans are very, very good at.
Yeah.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, I think I just lost like maybe half of our listenership by offensive comments there on people's taste in sound and game audio. But anyway, moving along.
Yes, indeed. You know, there's an interesting spin-off topic that's sort of relevant to the question of sufficiency in audio quality. You know, in the art world, and especially the digital art world, there has been a lot of discussion lately about algorithmically generated art, where these algorithms basically train themselves on everything out there in Google, and then you can type in a random juxtaposition of different phrases, and it will, quote-unquote, creatively try to come up with a piece of art that blends together those ideas. And there's been some discussion as to whether the results of that process are sufficient for certain uses, like if you're writing a magazine article and you need, maybe it's about the moon and you just need an abstract, arty, quote unquote, picture of the moon, can an AI art algorithm generate that? And the answer might be yes. So turning back to audio, we haven't talked about the state of the art of truly generative composition, but is there anything out there suggestive that there are tools in terms of generative music that can start to replace some of the more utilitarian uses of music in games?
I don't know, but a game that I've been playing, I've stopped playing now, but I was playing during this summer break, was No Man's Sky. And I'm not totally sure the extent to which the audio in No Man's Sky is totally algorithmic. I know that it's, do you know, Vince? Is it,
I think there's some algorithm, but I thought it was mostly this post-rock group that composed a lot of the score, actually.
Oh, really? Okay, then never mind.
Disregard. No offense intended to that group.
Disregard, then.
I mean, algorithmicity, the degree to which algorithms are used is a sliding scale. You know, anything from you might have the Logic drummer plugin sort of digitally improvising details of a drum line, or you might have your entire score created by algorithms. So there's a spectrum of possibility. I think it's easier for algorithmic music to exist bespoke to a particular project. I was just curious if there's something equivalent to those AI tools that you can just anyone can access from anywhere. Something where you could say, please create a piece of music like Bach meeting like Joan Jett, and it'll spit out some sort of digitally interpolated idea of what those two things are. I'm guessing not, but I'm kind of curious if anything has made its way out of the halls of academia into the mainstream.
I want to say that there are various companies that are basically positioning themselves similarly to library music companies, except instead of having a big trove of music, they have these algorithms and software that people can create an account with this company, and they are able to use credits in order to get this company or the software to generate sound for their needs. The first one that came to mind was Aiva, AIVA, which has been around for a few years now, but they've had AI generated music by this particular company do things often connected with other tech endeavors, like NVIDIA used their music for a press conference and a promotional campaign for GPUs like a few years back. So there are a few companies like this And every now and then I'll see things about AI music, but it really is about sort of training neural networks on these various sounds. And these experiments sort of go all across the board. Things like, oh, can I make the sound of an EDM track or like a drum and bass track? Or can I make the sound of an instrument after being trained on a library of what this instrument can do? Which is kind of cool. It's still not super effective and usable right now, but it is also neat to contrast that with the literal decades of research that has existed in the past of a music algorithm trained on notes. You know, it's so funny that we've had back in the 80s and 90s a lot of research into how do we create Bach or Mozart or the Beatles, and you can address it from that note perspective. And nowadays, we don't really care about that. We want the overall tone and sound of it. And maybe eventually we'll see some intersection of these two approaches to creating sound come together and make something that sounds good. I'm not sure when it will happen. I haven't quite seen it yet.
Yeah, we're not quite there yet. I think I actually saw on Twitter, it must have been maybe retweeted by you, Vince, or somebody from our game audio circles, had retweeted a country and western song that was generated by AI in the same vein that, you know, you've got these AI-generated artworks. This was a country and western song generated by AI. Not actually, at least from the sound of it, it didn't sound like it was based on notes, and then you just plug notes into like a general MIDI set and off you go. Not like that. But actually the sound was synthesized and generated from scratch to sound like country and western music with a vocal.
Huh.
I think it was, did you tweet something like that, Vince?
I feel like I did, but I wish I could remember what exactly that was. I'm actually looking furiously through my liked and retweeted tweets to see if anything jogs my memory.
Yeah, anyway, it was, and yeah, it's not quite there yet. I mean, you can hear what it's trying to do, and that the sort of the textures of the voice and the sound of the instruments are, you know, kind of in the right direction, but it's, you know, it's stiff and artificial and, you know, not very convincing really as a piece of music. But I think it's only a matter of time. We're not quite there yet, but it's only a matter of time. Of course, there's a whole sort of ethical discussion after that, of like artistic discussion, the same kind of discussion that follows on from AI generated imagery as well, will probably follow for AI generated music when it comes to fully synthesized AI generated music like that.
Well, we'll see where it goes. For now, I think our jobs are safe as sound designers and music composers. Knock on wood.
I'm sort of reminded there's a famous clip of a quite legendary bass player called Anthony Jackson, who's at the sort of the dawn of the MIDI sequencer in the early 80s as a common thing that you would find in pop music. Anthony Jackson is talking about how he said the day that a machine outplays me as a bass player will be the day that you can put me in the ground. And he said, I'm deadly serious. I'm deadly serious that I'll never allow myself to be outplayed by the machine. Talking about, you know, synth bass lines programmed into a MIDI sequencer versus a bass guitarist playing on a record. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, the idea of artificial intelligence as being, you know, scary and threatening and, you know, coming to take over the human role. It's an idea that's been around for quite some time now.
I can mm-hmm. even think of the legend and the song of John Henry, I think, the gentleman who was sort of a miner who challenged the newly developed steam engine to kind of a tunnel off. And he won, but then he dropped dead of a heart attack right after winning. So it was kind of a Pyrrhic victory.
Right. Oof.
On that cheerful note.
Yeah, I guess we've been going at it for almost an hour now. So I guess it's time for some conspicuous consumption. Alex, have you encountered anything cool out there in game world and the audio world, or perhaps the game audio world?
Yes, I have actually. I've been on a little bit of a sort of a cyberpunk fascination, and I've been downloading and playing a bunch of different cyberpunk themed games. And there's a game that is set in a cyberpunk context, but it's actually a card battling game, or what do you call it? Card collector game. It's called City Wars Tokyo Reign. Actually, Eurogamer did a very, very positive review of it just today, I think. It's a new card battler game. If you watch the trailer video for it, you'll see what I mean. The game audio is exceptionally good. It's great. The music is by Mitch Murder, who is a famous Swedish synthwave artist who also uses Renoise as a top piece of trivia there for you. But the sound effects and the music and just the game audio as a whole is just excellent. It's just really fun, juicy, visceral, lovely work on the sound effects. And it all keys together with the animation very, very nicely. If you like card games, highly recommend it. I myself actually have never played a card game before, like a video game card game. This is my first one. I got it just because the trailer, it seemed really cool and the sound effects seemed really good. So I wanted to, you know, buy it for game audio research purposes. And for that objective, it's been very, very, very successful. So yes, recommended. City Wars Tokyo Reign.
Ooh, cool. What are you playing this on?
PC.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was just wondering where I should grab it. On Steam, I guess. Cool.
Yes, Steam. It's actually, not anymore. It was 20% off a few weeks ago, but it's only like 11 euros. So what, with $12 or whatever that would be in US dollars. So,
yeah, that's
very affordable. So recommended.
Cool. What about you, Mike?
I've been going down a Trent Reznor / Atticus Ross film score rabbit hole, listening to their atmospheric and very sonically interesting scores. Some that leapt out at me were Social Network and Gone Girl. Just a really interesting sound. It's there are sometimes tracks that I think just a casual listener would enjoy, a lot of that on the Social Network score, and others that I think are more for the attentive palate of a composer appreciating the craftsmanship. But it has really taught me interesting things about what can be done under the broad umbrella of ambience and minimalism while still being very expressive.
That sounds good.
How about yourself, Vince?
Let's see. The last game that I've played is a little bit silly, kind of throwback, but I've had a lot of fun with it, which is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Shredder's Revenge, which is a brand new game in that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles side-scroller, belt-scroller, arcade-style multiplayer beat 'em up genre. I had a lot of fun with these games back in the 90s, which is way too long ago now. And I decided to grab this game, and I was basically stuck to the TV for the 2-3 hours that was required to actually play through this game. Me and five other friends. It was really quite fun. But besides the game itself, there's the music. So it's composed mostly by this dude, T. Lopez, and it basically takes the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles musical sound from the 90s and projects it forward into now with just how fun and fusion-y it all is. There's a lot of rocking synth work, a lot of great solos. And because Konami, the original publisher of those Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles back in that era of the NES, the Super Nintendo, they haven't really been doing these types of games for a few decades now. They really haven't established what that sound could have been in the intervening years. So listening to this soundtrack has actually been really fun for me. This is an alternate world where if Konami and their at the time legendary music sound team was still continuously building on what their sound was, the sound of Konami, the sound of their beat 'em up games, what the music could have sounded like. And I think T. Lopez did a really good job of making something that was incredibly fresh, but also very much rooted and very aware of where it came from before. So a really fun game to play and listen to.
Cool.
Yeah. So I guess with that, this was episode 229 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we will also post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Game Audio Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I just said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while we log off. Bye.